Friday, September 18th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, who had an affair, had members of his staff go to authorities with evidence of kickbacks, had a businessman provide home furnishings, had the same businessman hire a mistress, was acquitted by the Texas Senate over the weekend. Why lawyering like this?
With respect to that legacy, his milk carton has expired. It's over. When he gets up there and looks you in a straight face and says it's a crime to investigate whether or not something is a crime, come on. We were born at night, but not last night. That is dumber than a bucket of hair.
The context for those statements by Dan Cogdell in the defense of Ken Paxton matter a little bit. What matters just as much was that Cogdell's a really good lawyer, or at least a really interesting lawyer, kind of a fun lawyer. He was played by Giovanni Ribisi in the Showtime David Koresh series. Another fun lawyer was Paxton defense lawyer Tony Busby, who dispatched with usually credible witnesses, like a Texas Ranger who he subjected to dismissals like this.
You have a guy 6'6", wears a hat, cloaked with the authority of the state.
I know I'm not really getting to the nuts and bolts of the case, but trust me, the defense didn't either. And that was fine with all but two of the 19 Republican senators in the Texas Senate. One of the main theories of the defense's case was that Dade Phelan, Speaker of the Texas House, which was the body to impeach Paxton, was drunk.
Dade Phelan got his feelings hurt. He was so drunk handling the House business, knowing full well that they had no evidence to support an impeachment and they hadn't done their homework. When Ken Paxton says, hey man, you embarrassed the devil out of yourself, you should resign, they sped up the process and impeached this man.
Wait, that's the explanation for all of this? Why did this happen?
I'll tell you why. On May 19th, 2023, Speaker Dade Phelan was so drunk while running House business, he could barely even hold the gavel.
All of that, the entire evidence of Dade Phelan being drunk was a 43-second clip, which right afterwards, he did slur his words in the clip, and then right afterwards he didn't. We should also note that Phelan is also a Republican, just not a Ken Paxton Trumpian-type Republican. Also, that 43 seconds or however much slurring that occurred, it had nothing to do with the impeachment other than good lawyering or relying on more circumstantial evidence than the killer smoking gun explicit quid pro quo evidence. Other than that, Paxton was acquitted because of political calculation, and an accurate political calculation. The Republicans in the Senate, including Ken Paxton's wife, by the way, saw that a majority of their constituents would punish them if they convicted Paxton, so they didn't. The lawyering helped them to get to acquittal, but they wanted to go there anyway. The mention you heard in the first clip of legacy, which was invoked by both the defense and the House managers, served to underscore that ex-senators have legacies, current senators have power and offices and salaries and respect, or whatever respect is left in a Texas state house after the battle lines have been drawn and crossed. Paxton, in a statement afterwards, said, quote, "The sham impeachment coordinated by the Biden administration with liberal House Speaker Dade Phelan and his kangaroo court has cost taxpayers millions of dollars, disrupted the work of the Office of Attorney General, and left a dark and permanent stain on the Texas House." Paxton still faces a felony fraud case and an FBI investigation. On the show today, it's a full show given over to Spencer Cox, the governor of the state of Utah. He's chair of the National Governors Association. Cox has been fighting hyperpartisanship and polarization in Utah for years, and he now takes his efforts national. He has launched a new initiative called Disagree Better. I disagree. No, actually, I don't. And that makes me better. To talk to us more about the initiative and his time in office, Governor Spencer Cox up next.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cases solved using forensic genealogy. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about this remarkable new crime-solving tool, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing it. I include input from law enforcement to give you the inside scoop that we all crave with a straightforward, no-nonsense delivery. You can find DNA ID on any podcast platform. Episodes come out weekly on Mondays.
Spencer Cox is the 18th governor of Utah. He's also one of the most prominent politicians trying to tamp down polarization. A couple of years ago, we had Rob Willer of Stanford on the show, and he had a lab that ran experiments called the Strengthening Democracy Challenge. He took 250 submissions, and the best on a couple of different metrics was a video made by Governor Cox and his Democratic opponent about comedy, civility, and shared humanity.
I'm Spencer Cox, your Republican candidate for Utah governor.
And I'm Chris Peterson, your Democratic candidate for governor.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other.
But our common values transcend our political differences, and the strength of our nation rests on our ability to see that.
Cox is now chairman of the National Governors Association, and he announced an initiative called Disagree Better. I agreed to have him on my show, or maybe it was the other way around. Welcome to The Gist.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be with you.
So other than, and this is a big deal, just putting it on people's radar and saying that it's a virtue and a value to disagree better, what are the actual steps, tricks, techniques that people who may be part of the NGA or anyone governed by members of the NGA, what can they actually employ?
Well, there's lots of different things we can do. And by the way, we are using the best science behind this. You've talked about some of that. We've met with the policy labs at Stanford and Duke and Dartmouth who are doing this work and truly believe that the science behind it is real and that it can make a difference. Governor Polis of Colorado, who's my vice chair, and I, we've talked about these issues as well. And there are certain things that we can actually do. One of them, of course, is spending less time on social media and more time face-to-face with people who are different than us, who disagree with us, to give us an opportunity to actually practice this. Family members are a great way to do it. Your MAGA uncle or your woke niece having an opportunity to engage with them. One of the real practical tips that we've been taught and that we teach other people is a very simple question, and the question is, "Tell me more." So when you're having a discussion there's a little tension, you really disagree with the person, you want to fight back, the first thing you should do is just say, "Hey, tell me more about why you believe what you believe." And you actually keep asking that until you get to the root of it. And what you will generally find out is at the core of whatever the person you disagree with, their argument is something that you actually do agree with. It's, I care about my country, or I care about my family, or I care about my religion. And then you can start kind of rebuilding that relationship from the core of that. The other thing that's really interesting is by asking that question, that curiosity, "Tell me more," really trying to understand where the other person has coming from. It takes some of the tension out of the room, and almost always that person will be more willing to listen to your reasoning, to listen to you, and then you have a chance to persuade. Sadly, as a country, we've really gotten away from persuasion, especially our political leaders. And we just started focusing on owning the other side or tearing the other side down. The second thing that I think is really important in this practical approach is that it allows us to overcome the perception gap that exists. It's not what Republicans and Democrats believe. It's what Republicans think Democrats believe and what Democrats think Republicans believe. And that gap is much narrower than we think. The problem is that every Democrat out there thinks that all Republicans are like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene. And every Republican thinks that Democrats are all like AOC. And it turns out that's not the case. There are extremes in both party. According to the latest data that we got just last week from Dartmouth, it's about 6% of Democrats and about 8% of Republicans that represent those far extremes, but they get the most attention. And so we just assume that when we're engaging with someone from the other side, they're either that 6% or that 8%. Turns out that's not the case. And so if we can learn to disagree in a healthier manner, we can actually start to solve some of the biggest problems facing our country.
Yes, and there's even some statistically unbelievable things that people believe that just can't be true. Like Democrats believe something like 20 or 30% of Republicans are in the top 1%. It's mathematically impossible.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Republicans believe that some gigantic number of Democrats are on welfare. So the perceptions are there. Do you think you come to this by temperament, by upbringing, by instinct? Did you have to be convinced to favor these policies?
Yeah, it's something I had to be convinced of. And I can tell you the natural me is I'm an attorney. I'm a trial attorney. That's what I went to school to do. I left the practice of law to run a business. But the natural me is to fight and to punch back and to tear people down and to win. I constantly have to be reminded of this. My staff constantly reminds me of this. I fail sometimes. It's very easy and natural. And I think that's true of all of us, by the way. I love looking at kind of the founders of our country. There's some great quotes out there by John Adams when he talks about kind of the natural political instincts of human beings, and that we are, if we don't practice like temperament and patience and humility, that we are all politically ravenous beasts of prey. That's kind of his idea. And I think it's true of most of us. And so they built these institutions to try to hold back those worst instincts. Sadly, we have new institutions that have kind of unleashed those on a bigger scale, social media and others. And so it's something I've really have to work on. And I'm grateful for people who helped me to work on that.
Yeah. Now, of course, John Adams also said that politics was just organized systemic hatred. So it wasn't that he was always appealing to the better nature of our angels, or maybe he was aware of it. But I want to ask you, have you ever used the tell me more technique such that whatever they told you actually wound up changing your mind?
Yeah, sure. And I think I've changed some people's minds too by using that technique. And there's lots of I'm trying to think of some right off the top of the bat.
Because I'm thinking if your constituents vote for you, he has these policies. He seems like a nice guy. We'd rather have a nice guy who advances the policies that we want. Okay, he talks about tell me more, and now all of a sudden he doesn't believe in the policies he ran on. Is that a good brand for a politician?
Yeah, no, look, again, that's part of the problem, right? It's kind of this all or nothing mentality. We've had several instances over the past couple of years here in the state of Utah where I've been able to engage on big issues that I think are really important, like water conservation, something that's been facing the state of Utah, and listening to people who are arguing that we need significantly more of it than we've been doing, and sitting down and trying to understand the science behind it, trying to put aside kind of my own biases to get to the very best policy. I can tell you one very controversial one that we had just recently in our state. It was around transgender healthcare for minors. Right, we passed a comprehensive bill in the state of Utah to prohibit what we feel is medically unnecessary and very dangerous. Some of the things that we've been doing to our minors before their brains are fully developed, and they're obviously the LGBTQ community was very upset about that. But prior to going into that legislative session, I invited transgender youth and their parents over to the governor's mansion with leadership from our House and Senate, as well as the person who was going to be running this bill. And we had some, I think, very powerful conversations. And I think seeing real people and listening to real people, it changed the tone. We did pass the bill. There were a couple changes that were made to the bill that I think would not have happened if we hadn't had those conversations. For example, we set aside $1 million to help these young people who would not be getting the medications that they could get in other states, to help them transition, puberty blockers and things that we feel are dangerous. We did set aside $1 million to help them get therapy, to help them get professional counseling, and to support some organizations in our state that do that. So I think that's one instance where, again, we stood by the policy because I believe in the policy. It was a controversial policy, but we did some other things that I think would not have happened if we weren't more open to having these really important conversations.
Okay. I read your signing statements on that. I've heard you talk about this. I also read a column by Michael Hiltzik in the LA Times, and this is a columnist who applauded you when you vetoed a bill disallowing trans participation in youth sports. And as you rightly said, and got a lot of plaudits for it, I think there were 4 transgender kids in Utah at the at that time and let us not discriminate against them. But then I'm sure you read the column. He called you a hypocrite. He said that you've signed the harshest anti-trans bill in the country. The headline was that Governor Cox vetoed an anti-trans bill out of, quote, compassion, then signed a worse one. And so my point is not to get into the back and forth, but if you believe what Hiltzik does, what others do, that this is just an egregious step against the rights of trans people, what is the role of comity and getting along and being nice about it when the stakes are as high as they perceive them to be?
Well, sure. And let me be clear about a couple things. So first of all, again, I think the I know you don't want to get into the back and forth, and I won't. But the reasons we did it really matter, and I think the science behind it really matters. And I think he's just wrong, and that's okay. Again, this is the piece of disagreeing though that is so important, and that is that we can disagree without hating each other. We can disagree without tearing each other down. We can attack ideas and not people. And see, the problem here is this attack on me, for example, on this issue, that the only reason I could ever sign a bill like that is because I'm a bigot and I hate trans people. Okay. Mm-hmm. See, that's the problem, the very problem with the arguments that we're having today. That is absolutely not true, because I know it's not true in my case. I love our transgender youth in our state. I care deeply about them. And I feel strongly that what we are doing to them and what is happening here is making life worse for them. And I believe I have the science to back that up and to prove it. And so instead of attacking intentions, let's have the argument about the science. And about why we're doing what we're doing. This wasn't the worst law or the strictest law. There are 17 others that I would say are harsher than the law that we passed here in Utah. But that's what we've come down to as a society. If you disagree with me, then it must be because you're a racist or because you're a bigot or because you absolutely hate the other side. And there's no room for nuance in those discussions. There's also no room for changing anybody's mind, because if he thinks that calling me a bigot is going to change my mind, I've just never seen that work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen. It's not effective.
So if I was in the Utah legislature, which could never happen, I would definitely vote against that bill. And I'd also enjoy whatever kind of discussions that you and I and people who believe in disagreeing better would have. But so I just want to say that now Hiltzik writes, and I'm not picking on Hiltzik, this is very typical of this conversation. He writes, Republicans have been trying to roll back anti-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people, but they've especially targeted the transgender community. The reason isn't hard to discern. In their crass and cruel quest for targets to unite their base against, they had run out of acceptable candidates for discrimination and abuse. And I would say, going by what you preach and what you talk about, what he's done is he's impugned your intention. He explained what your motivation was. And I think that almost never works. Now, I don't think his point and the point of those who would oppose the bill, as I would have, is to do anything other than to, you know, heap scorn upon the bill. But I think it almost always fails when you try to talk about and guess the intention of someone else. How could you not, you, Governor Cox, not be offended by those words?
Sure. And Mike, that's you're making my point for me. You're absolutely right. By impugning the intentions of somebody, it always backfires. It just hardens the person in their position, because, you know, I am deeply offended because it's not true. And that makes me want to push back even harder. Right. And so I think that's a huge mistake that we make. I will also say that the other problem with his entire thesis is that same legislature passed a conversion therapy ban unanimously, a very conservative legislature. At the same time they signed this other bill, they passed a conversion therapy ban in support of the LGBTQ community. Now that got almost no attention, right? He obviously doesn't write about it because it would undermine his entire thesis that these are just a bunch of terrible, bigoted, awful people who want to do harm. Now, there probably are people who are terrible, awful people who want to do harm that may have come to the same conclusion. I think they're very, very few and far between, but I understand that, but his approach doesn't help his own cause. And that's what, when I hear this, and I hear it often from the left, how can you disagree better with people who want to end your very existence, right? That's kind of, I think, what we're getting at here, and the I think the counter argument is, well, because hating those people doesn't help your cause at all. In fact, it makes it actually worse. And there are better ways to engage without impugning the integrity or the intentions of the people that you're arguing with.
One more question. I'm going to get back to the process, but on this bill, I've said this on my show. First of all, I know all about the Tavistock Clinic. I know about Finland's requirements, Sweden's requirements. I think that the United States Medical Association would be better to adopt those requirements. So I'll put that out there. However, in the history of the interplay between legislators and medicine, I could think of no other example where elected officials got the medicine more correct than doctors did. Sure, there were many medical procedures which have eventually been banned, but they were largely discredited by the medical community beforehand. Can you think of another case where elected officials, state officials, banned a procedure that doctors said that the vast majority of the medical community say was an acceptable procedure and the legislators were right?
Well, that's a fair question, and I can tell you I don't know that I can answer it. I can't right off the top of my head in this very moment. I would probably have to do a little research. There are lots of times when doctors have been wrong over time, and I think I could probably point some of those out. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with eggs and how terrible eggs are for you. I'm sure some legislators said that's dumb, and we need to protect the poultry industry, and they got that wrong. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here a little bit, but I do think it is important. Those other things that you did mention, and that's where I went. I actually believe that that here in the United States, this issue is so polarizing, and including among doctors. I had lots of doctors reach out to me and say, "Hey, we don't feel comfortable with what's happening out there, but we also don't feel like we can speak up because we feel like the associations, the medical associations, and the medical establishment will push back too hard on us and we'll get canceled. And so we just don't feel comfortable. We think we are actually doing harm here." So I did go to Europe to look at those other countries that
you literally traveled to the countries.
I was over there last year, but looked at the studies and what was happening over there to try to get a little more unbiased perspective. Looked at all of the treatment that's happening in the United States was based on a Dutch study many years ago that really doesn't match up to what we're seeing now. And the explosion that we're seeing in this space is really difficult for people to explain. And so one of the other changes we made is we pushed pause. This wasn't a prohibitive ban forever. It was we're pushing pause until we can get some more data and more information. That was one of the changes that came out of the meeting that, again, disagreeing better, where we got together and met with advocates from the other side. That was one of the changes that was made to the bill. And so again, I think there is a better way to do this.
And we'll be back in a minute with more of Utah Governor Spencer Cox. We're back now with Spencer Cox, Governor of Utah, Chair of the National Governors Association. And I'm going to move on more onto what the project, the Disagree Better project, is all about. And first of all, it is in my sweet spot. I talk about these kind of initiatives a lot. I subscribe to a somewhat wonky, but I find very informative newsletter called Beyond Intractability. I don't know if you know that one.
I do. Yes.
It's a good one. They're always mentioning you. So I'm glad you're very, very glad you're doing it. My questions are more about the replicability of your approach in other states, countries, political contexts. So I have three thoughts about this. One is that politics in Utah is so Republican dominated that you can very much afford to be maximally magnanimous because there's really no chance of Democrats ever getting your way. You could argue that your opponent, your Democratic opponent in that governor's race, Chris Peterson, his top achievement was being invited to do that video. So what about that? That you are in a different position than many state legislatures or governors where it really is rough and tumble?
Well, look. I think if you're going to make that argument, let's assume it's true. I'll push back in a second, but let's assume it's true. Then that's true of a lot of states. We are very polarized based on state now. There are a lot of very red states and a lot of very blue states. So if I can do it in Utah based on that assumption, then we should be able to do it in a lot of different states. And again, making the argument that Congress is so gerrymandered now that we don't have many congressional seats that are are really in play anymore, then shouldn't more members of Congress be able to do this if we're assuming that's true? Now, I will say, again, I disagreeing better isn't just disagreeing between Republicans and Democrats. I think the divide on the right and the divide on the left are almost as strong as the divide between the right and the left. And so I think that these that the things we're talking about here are really important no matter where you are. And again, I'm trying to make the argument that this isn't just good for the country, although I think it is. And I would go so far as to say that the direction we're headed on is unsustainable and will only lead to something very, very dark. And I'm talking like 1850s and 1860s dark if we don't stop hating each other as a country. And so I think that this is an existential crisis and that we should be doing this because it's the right thing to do. But I actually believe that it's also politically viable that this is what there is a majority of the country that is hungry for this. We're just not giving them any other options. And again, as we look at the data, there is an exhausted majority out there that hate the polarization that we're seeing in our country right now, and want something different. It's amazing to me that saw some numbers a month ago. 70% of Republicans don't want Donald Trump to run for office. 75% of Democrats don't want Joe Biden to run for office. People are dying for another option. And I believe that candidates who will kind of adopt this framework will actually do better in their own races and in their own states, even in very purple states where it is rough and tumble.
So you're right. This is not just about left and right, but on the replicability question, I think about Utah. Utah is the state, I think it's the state that most exemplifies shared values. It's a largely homogenous state. My statistic might be a little off. You might correct me, but there are 104 seats in your state legislature, and I think 89 or 90 are filled by members of the LDS church. The state's 60% LDS. So the point is that Utah almost has an unfair advantage, the advantage that highly functional democracies like New Zealand or Scandinavia or Uruguay and South America, they're small, they're homogenous, and the people there have no reason to suspect the motives of their rivals, which is what we're talking about. Their rivals aren't their mortal enemies. The stakes aren't something like, we think this one other group will vanquish us. It's just not the case in Utah, but it is the case in very much, it's very much the case in the rest of the country. What do you think about that?
Well, look, there clearly Utah has some advantages when it comes to this issue, and I'm not going to try to eschew any of those. Although I will say, you know, I hear all the time, well, you're the whitest state in the nation. We're not. We're like 17th. We are changing very rapidly. We're the fastest growing state in the nation over the past 10 years, and that growth has been external. So these are people coming in who are not from the state, who maybe don't have some of those shared values, and so it is. I don't think it's as easy a cakewalk as most people would assume from the outside. Certainly we have our detractors and we get a tremendous amount of pushback here as well. One of the reasons I care so much about this initiative is because I want Utah to stay that way. I want some of those values that I think transcend any religion or any race. I think they're shared values from throughout history, throughout American history. I think if you look to some of our past leaders, again, the founding fathers, Abraham Lincoln, these are the things that he lived and talked about. I made my entire cabinet read Team of Rivals because I believe in that Lincoln style of governing, of bringing people together. And so I don't think that this is an issue that transcends that. My question to you is, and my question to your listeners is, why is it that we believe that there's one other group out there that is going to end us and destroy us and tear us apart? And I believe it's because our political leaders, by and large, have figured out how to really monopolize on that fear to divide us for their own benefit. And so if we can, this is why this initiative is so important. And again, according to Stanford, they're telling us if you can get people in high political office who disagree with each other to come together, so not just me and my opponent, the Democrat who may or may not have an opportunity to get elected in this state, but myself and Governor Jared Polis, where we can get in on a podcast or on stage or in an ad together, which we filmed one together, showing that we can disagree without hating each other. That actually goes a long ways to clearing up that perception gap that we talked about. The danger with that perception gap is when you think the other side is crazy and willing to violate democratic norms, then you are willing to do that on your side as well. If you're saying, okay, I know that those crazy Democrats don't care about the Constitution, so why should I care about the Constitution? I'm willing to tear things down just to hold them off. It feels like I have to fight fire with fire. That's the danger that we're facing. And look, the only logical end to this is people shooting each other. And so we have to stop the insanity. And we're trying to provide some political cover for people to try a different way.
When you assign Team of Rivals to an actual cabinet, does everyone in the cabinet see themselves as Stanton and none as Chase?
I think that's definitely the case. Yeah, they're all asking themselves, wait, is it I? You know, where do I fit in this book?
Yeah, you got a bunch of William Stewart. So the last replicability question is that I've read a little bit about your political rise, and it seemed like none of the tactics of polarization helped you. You talked about how perhaps temperamentally you're a fighter, but you didn't try to divide your constituency, and then you were somewhat surprisingly tapped for lieutenant governor. But there are many people who are in their positions because polarization works for them. Many people in our House of Representatives, many governors, I live in New York, I don't think that being brass knuckled and sharp elbowed hurt Andrew Cuomo, for instance, in his rise. So I believe—
But it probably helped in his fall.
It did. But I believe in rational self-interest. And can you really make the case to the vast majority of other elected officials who might owe their position to the fact that they're Tea Party favorites or that they're Justice Democrat all-stars? Can you make the case to them to disagree better and give up some of the more polarizing aspects of their min or policy positions?
Well, look, I'm certainly going to try, and I'm not here to say that I can change the world, or that a few governors can change decades of polarization that's happening in our country. But I do think there are some kind of evidences out there that the pendulum is starting to swing back a little bit. I think you saw it in some of the races that were out there this past midterm. I think you saw it in Georgia with my good friend Brian Kemp. I think you saw it in Arizona where Republicans should have performed much better, but we put the most polarizing figures up there and they were very unsuccessful. And so I think there are opportunities for us to point out where it is not working, where it is leading to actual political losses. And look, most politicians that I talk to, even if they feel like they have to do this, they don't like it. It's not what they would prefer to do. They're tired of it. Even if it got them there, eventually they come for you too. You can never be extreme enough. You can never be loud enough. But one of the things I just have to point out, Mike, is that this is not another civility initiative. It is not just about being nice to each other and getting along. It really is about disagreeing, and it is about staying true to our core beliefs and our core values. But again, doing that in a way that doesn't tear other people down, doing it in a way that attacks ideas and not people, and again, doing it in a way that doesn't question every time the intentions of the other person or the other party. That again leads us to that you can't play with matches all day and then be surprised when there's a giant fire. And that's what we're doing.
So here's my last question, then I'll let you go govern. I think this is right. Your first veto was of a bill that was sponsored by a senator named Mike McKell. And Mike McKell is your brother-in-law?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. The question is, does the fact that it's a family member who you veto make it more polarizing and rough around the edges, or does it tamp down some of the hard feelings?
It makes it more fun. There is no question about it. It was so much more fun. I hope Mike is listening to this this podcast. If not, I'm going to send it to him and make sure that he does. No, it made it I think a little less polarizing. Because people understand that I have a job to do, and I'm going to do that job whether you're related to me or not. That's part of being a good governor. And I felt like that was a bad bill for our state, and so I vetoed it. But look, where it does play out, I can say this, is that I veto very few bills. And that's because I work very closely with my legislature. I work hard to have relationships with them. I work hard so that we can work on these things before we get to the point where I have to veto something. And because of those relationships, and because I'm not out there just trying to attack them or own them or throw them under the bus at every turn, they're much more likely when I say, hey, when I give them a call and say, I have a real problem with your bill. Could you make a couple changes and maybe we can get there, and then we get to better policy for the state, and I don't have to veto their bill.
Spencer Cox is the governor of Utah, now chairman of the National Governors Association, where he has an initiative called Disagree Better, which we've been talking about. Thank you so much, Governor.
Thanks, Mike.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.